sleds with domed driver's compartments, oval cargo beds, and anti-gravity pads bulging out from their sides, sat facing away from each other in double rows, creating a broad center aisle between their rear bumpers. A small army of alien stevedores, mostly jackals and grunts, was unloading the sled's long cargo beds into the central aisle. From what John could see, it appeared that once the crates were set on the pavement, they floated to the elevator on their own, then disappeared. The Black Widow launched a massive volley of missiles, and suddenly the monitor showed only flame and smoke. The Prowler slowed to a near hover and began to swing her nose back and forth, chugging noticeably as she filled the air with cannon fire. The alert lamps flashed green as the jump hatch opened. Then Fred and Kelly were leading the first rows of black daggers out onto the surface of the alien planet. John and Linda followed seconds later, dropping 2.5 meters through thick black smoke. Naraka's gravity was only about 3/4 of Earth's standard, so the descent was slow and easy, and they landed on a smooth surface that seemed oddly clear of wreckage and rubble. John felt something scraping across the top of his helmet. Thinking he was taking fire, he dropped to a knee and whirled around, and found himself beneath the Black Widow, being carried forward behind a line of similarly kneeling ODSTs. In front of them, the murky shapes of dozens of burning haulage sleds lay rolled on their sides. A few were resting on their tops, their hinged anti-gravity pads swinging lazily as they slid toward the space elevator. John glanced down and saw that he was sliding along an emerald green band of glassy pavement. It appeared level, but it felt like he was on green ice, going down a gentle hill. He slammed the butt of his M90 against it, half expecting to see a web of cracks racing outward from the impact point, and felt nothing. His shotgun just stopped descending and wouldn't go any farther. "Weird, huh?" Fred said, speaking over team comm. John looked over to see the ghostly silhouette of a still-burning haulage sled drifting past in the opposite direction. Fred stepped out from behind it and took a knee next to John, and together they passed beneath the Black Widow's now silent nose cannons. "Get on the gray pavement and you stop moving," Fred continued. "The green bands must be some sort of conveyor zone. They carry you right into the elevator." John peered into the smoke ahead, trying to make sense of the jumble of shapes and flickering cones of orange, then gave up and switched to his motion tracker. Immediately he spotted Kelly 20 meters ahead, with 4 ODSTs arrayed to either side of her in a skirmish line. He couldn't tell what lay directly in front of her, but judging from where the space elevator dropped down out of the clouds, she was about 100 meters short of the entrance. "Any contact?" John asked. "After the barrage the Widow laid down? We think there are a few wounded brutes hiding behind some wrecked sleds in front of the elevator plinth, but they haven't shown much interest in coming out to fight. That's why I came back to report." Before Fred could continue, Small Bear's voice sounded over the platoon channel. "Third platoon clear." "Platoon clear," Gite acknowledged. "Widow out." With the smoke so thick that John could barely see the Prowler's wings, much less the blast zone behind its thruster nozzles, he checked his motion tracker again and confirmed that the rest of the platoon was already spreading out in another skirmish line and moving forward. "Affirmative," John said. "Widow out. Thanks for the ride." "Maybe you shouldn't thank me, Chief," Gite said. "You could be on your own destroying those 10 targets. John's gut instantly clenched. "The other bats didn't make it?" "That's what I'm hearing," Gite said. "The Widowmaker and Quiet Death got jumped on entry and had to turn back or go down. The Quiet Man broke up on final drop. Comms intercepted some chatter that sounded like the Spartans were picking up the surviving Black Daggers and pressing ahead. But it's hard to say how many there are and whether they'll make it to the elevator." "Acknowledged. Appreciate the update." John digested the failure and casualty rates with dismay. The 4 members of Gold Team had been divided equally between the Widowmaker and Quiet Death, and they were now completely out of the battle. But at least the Spartans aboard the Quiet Man seemed to be in one piece so far. That was Green Team, and if anyone could find a way to extract, Kurt 051 could. He started to wish Gite a safe flight, but the Black Widow was already standing on her tail and climbing for the sky. The thruster wash cleared the smoke long enough to reveal dozens of alien bodies dangling out of shattered pilot bubbles or lying pinned beneath overturned haulage sleds. It was a gruesome sight, and none of them wore armor, carried weapons, or showed any other sign of being in the military. John almost found himself regretting their deaths, until he remembered what the Covenant had done to Harvest and Etalon and Biko, and probably a dozen other worlds he had not yet heard about. The Covenant had started this bloody war, and John would not allow himself to feel bad about fighting it by their rules. The conveyor zone carried John and his companions to within a few meters of the skirmish line Kelly had set up. He turned back to Fred and spoke over team comm. "You were telling me about some wounded brutes?" "We think." Fred pointed into the smoke. "There are some haulage sleds ahead that have been pulled together to make a breastwork. We're guessing brutes, since they're probably the only ones strong enough to drag that stuff around on its side. We could try to go around." "But?" "But who likes getting shot in the back?" Fred said. "We need to take them out." "And quickly," John said. "If they're holed up, they're waiting for something." Fred tipped his helmet forward in agreement. "Maybe they've got support coming." "Or maybe they're waiting for a lockout barrier to power up," Linda added. "Could be anything," John said. The one thing nobody mentioned was shutting off power to the elevator. With thousands of tons of cargo in transit to a geostationary orbit tens of thousands of kilometers above the planet's surface, one did not simply shut off the power to a space elevator. Not unless they were ready for a high-velocity impact that would make a nuclear detonation seem like a grenade blast in comparison. "Whatever they're waiting for, let's be gone before it happens." John stepped off the conveyor zone. "Fred and Kelly, flank 'em. Linda, with me." A trio of status lights winked green, and Fred and Kelly disappeared into the smoke. Linda followed John over to an ODST who was hiding behind a burned-out haulage sled. John handed his M90 to the ODST, then pointed Linda to a nearby sled that was still smoking. "We'll need two, I think."
"Two should do," Linda said.
She secured her M99 to her Mjolnir, then stepped over to the still-smoking sled and started to push it toward the conveyor zone. John's sled was already adjacent, so he simply squatted next to it and waited for Linda to move hers into position. He switched to the platoon channel, then said, "Lieutenant Smallbear, Linda and I are going to force the enemy's hand. I'd suggest having the platoon fall in behind us and be ready to move fast." "You heard him," Smallbear said. "Move it!" Linda's sled scraped into place next to John's. The smoke ahead was still so thick that they could see barely 5 meters clearly, and make out shapes at no more than 10. The enemy barricade lay somewhere beyond, but when John looked skyward, he could still see the blue column of the elevator looming. It remained filled with the dark streaks of rising cargo. John looked over at Linda. 3. 2. She shoved her sled forward and he lifted, putting all of his strength and the Mjolnir armors into the effort. The sled came off the glassy pavement and partially flipped, then crashed down on the far side of the conveyor belt. It was more or less even with Linda's, but resting at an angle that left a small gap between the two vehicles. Close enough. John grabbed his M90 back from the ODST and stepped onto the conveyor zone. "Let's go," he said over the platoon channel. "And we need someone with a spanker up here." Smallbear barked, "Chavez!" A few seconds later, an ODST appeared with a rocket launcher and an extra set of barrels. In his black assault armor, he looked like all of the other ODSTs, except he was about a head taller and half an arm's length wider. John briefly thought about handling the spanker himself, then recalled what Johnson had said about trusting his people to do their jobs. He pointed Chavez toward the gap between the two vehicles. "The enemy has improvised a breastwork ahead of us," he said. "Both barrels, the instant you see it." "Will do, Master Chief." Chavez kneeled on pavement and laid the extra barrels next to him, then carefully pushed his weapon into the gap. John checked his motion tracker and saw that Lieutenant Smallbear and the rest of 3rd Platoon were lined up behind him in two well-spaced columns, weapons ready. Fred and Kelly reappeared on the tracker, about 10 meters ahead and a similar distance off to the side. "See anything yet?" John asked Chavez. Yellow flames suddenly filled John's vision as both rockets streaked away. Instead of immediately pulling out of the gap, Chavez reached for his extra set of barrels, then flew over backward, the spanker flying from his hands as he went down with a cluster of white-hot spikes protruding from his chest armor. John stuck his M90 into the brake and fired blindly, then pulled his arm back just as another cluster of spikes arrived and ricocheted off the chassis of the adjacent vehicle. He pumped another round into the shotgun's chamber and heard a series of thuds and bangs from his 10 o'clock a few meters away. Fred and Kelly's location, according to his motion tracker. Then Kelly's voice sounded over the platoon channel. Clear. John glanced down at Chavez, and his heart sank. It had been a small mistake, and one John had gotten away with himself a few times. But the brutes had been ready, and now Chavez lay on the glassy pavement, convulsing and kicking. Medic! John yelled. To make certain there would be no more mistakes, John stuck the shotgun back into the gap. Hey, Fred called. We got him! Just checking. Leaving Chavez for the medic, John stepped through the barricade he and Linda had erected, then saw Fred and Kelly peering over the brute's makeshift breastwork. A trio of haulage sleds had been tipped on their sides and dragged into place. The middle vehicle had an enormous hole in the cargo bed where Chavez's rockets had detonated, and through the opening John could see the upper body of a brute who had been blown apart at the middle. Three more brutes lay draped over the adjacent sleds, smoke still rising from the grenade craters in their backs. Sorry I doubted you, John said. Now grab as much ammunition as you can and get over here. We've got a ride to catch. John watched until Fred and Kelly returned to the conveyor zone and began to gather extra spanker barrels, then turned back to Chavez. The ODST had been dragged into cover by Small Bear and one of her troopers, and the platoon medic was using a plunger to feed something, probably biofoam, into the medical port on Chavez's assault armor. A 4-to-1 casualty ratio was nothing to complain about, but it had been John who ordered Chavez to step into that gap, and he could not help feeling sick about it. He thought of Johnson's words again, and pushed through. The platoon was carried out of the smoke into an abandoned sorting tunnel, where dozens of pad-tipped poles and odd-looking flashlight guns lay strewn to both sides of the conveyor zone. 50 meters ahead, the elevator plinth could now be seen clearly. It was a vast gray platform rimmed by a series of vertical pylons roughly 15 meters tall, each of which were anchored onto the surface, clearly part of a much larger machine buried below. At first blush, the pylon seemed to be channels for the elevator's energy, generating the blue beam from their tips, as well as from some hidden space underneath the platform. Meanwhile, the conveyor was still pushing battle debris into the blue column of the alien space elevator. Once inside, the debris, bodies and chunks of wreckage, would spread evenly across the beam and begin to rise, slowly at first, but steadily gathering velocity. By the time they vanished from sight 100 meters above, they were traveling too fast for the eye to follow. He briefly wondered how the aliens at the top of the elevator would react. After a moment, John turned back to Small Bear and nodded toward Chavez. Will he make it? If we could get him to a Class 1 combat hospital, maybe. But out here? She shook her head. It's the end of the line for him. Mehran is giving him the shot. The shot was a powerful narcotic ODST medics used to relieve the pain and anxiety of a dying trooper, especially when circumstances dictated they had to be abandoned in the field. From Small Bear's remark, John gathered that the medic was giving Chavez a lethal dose. He desperately wanted to say that he would carry the dying trooper, but the mission was just starting, and distracting himself with a casualty would only get more people killed. And he wasn't about to elevate someone else's risk by ordering them to carry a dying man into battle. Small Bear had made a sound decision, and he would not make anything better by second-guessing her. Chavez was a good trooper, and he deserves a big send-off. Small Bear retrieved the Fury tactical nuke from her magmount. What do you say, Master Chief? John turned toward the space elevator, and then back to Small Bear. Lock in 40 minutes. And leave it here. Chapter 26. Ninth Age of Reclamation. 36th Cycle. 176 Units. Covenant Battle Calendar. Fleet of Inexorable Obedience. Assault Carrier Pious Rampage. High Equatorial Orbit. Planet Zoist. Buta System. Tel Zatalai found his hand resting on the hilt of his energy sword. Again.
It was an unconscious action that had arisen with the summons to attend Fleetmaster Cavarossi, and the nearer he drew to the pious Rampage's high battle sanctum, the more powerful it became. And that was a problem. He had been summoned from the Sacred Whisper in the middle of a combat vigil, and now he was allowing his resentment to subvert his focus, with a battle coming. Zatalai reached the sanctum and paused at the threshold. The two Sangheili sentries snapped their carbines to present arms, clearing the entrance and indicating he was free to enter. Zatalai ignored them and remained where he was, thinking only of controlling his breath and diffusing his anger on each exhalation. The Spartans would come to him in their own time. He would not bring them any sooner by crouching in his observation blister, staring out at the emptiness to where he thought they should be. After a time, a sentry dared to speak. "You are free to enter, Blademaster. They are expecting you." "They?" Of course, it would have been the Sanshayum who sent for him, who believed that the Covenant should be able to command their enemies as they did their acolytes. Without responding to the sentry, Zatalai entered the sanctum. He was immediately confronted by a two-story tactical holograph of the Zoist planetary system, complete with its moon, its libration point outposts, and the complex of orbital fleet support stations known as the Ring of Mighty Abundance. The fleet of inexorable obedience was shown in its shielding circle. Even the positions of the outpost squadrons and fighter patrols were posted. What was lacking, of course, was any hint of where the enemy stealth craft might be. On the near side of the holograph stood 15 aides and plotters, all busy conversing with each other and pretending they had not noticed Zatalai's arrival. Fleetmaster Cavarossi was alone on the far side of the compartment, glaring at the holograph as he paced back and forth. The fleet's Sanshayum magistrate, the minor minister of artifact survey, sat in his anti-grav chair by the corner behind Cavarossi, stroking his chin waddles and swinging his long neck from side to side as he watched the fleetmaster pace. When Survey noticed Zatalai approaching, he floated his chair forward and extended a spindly finger toward Cavarossi. He's been like that since the attack on Outpost 3. Zatalai felt his hand dropping toward his energy sword and tried to go around. Survey blocked his way, and Zatalai found himself glancing around the compartment, wondering if anyone would be troubled enough by the Sanshayum's death to report it and risk the Silent Shadow's retaliation. "Perhaps you can make him see what a mistake this was," Survey said. "Mistake?" "That!" Survey flung a slender hand toward the holograph. "Surely you see what the humans are doing." "Launching a stealth attack on Zoist, as I predicted," Zatalai said. "What do you see?" "A diversion," Survey said. "A small force sent to hold us here while they attack High Charity." That illogical nonsense again. Zatalai sidestepped Survey's chair. When the Sanshayum tried to block his way once more, the Sangheili pushed the chair aside and continued toward Cavarossi. He noticed that his hand had returned to the hilt of his energy sword, and did not remove it. Cavarossi continued to pace and did not stop until Zatalai placed himself squarely in front of the Fleetmaster. "You summoned me, Fleetmaster." Zatalai's tone was intentionally flat and hard. "I was in the middle of a combat vigil." Cavarossi's gaze finally swung from the holograph, and Zatalai was not surprised to see that the Fleetmaster's eyes had gone soft with uncertainty. It was clear that Survey had been working on him, filling his head with reasons to return the fleet to High Charity. "I may have made a critical error in strategy, Blademaster." Cavarossi turned and pointed toward the tactical holograph. "The humans have attacked only our outposts." "So far," Zatalai said. It had appalled him to see the doubt in Cavarossi's eyes, but now he found himself awed by the Fleetmaster's honor. It had been Zatalai who argued for a retreat to defend Zoist, yet Cavarossi was blaming only himself. "More attacks will come." "And how long must we wait?" Survey demanded, floating up behind Zatalai. "Until High Charity itself has fallen?" When Zatalai did not reply, Cabarossi allowed his mandibles to gape ever so slightly in amusement. He pointed his finger at the holograph again, this time wagging it so Zatalai would look. "The humans are making only minor attacks with a small force," he said. "Three of their vessels have already withdrawn, and there are only a handful engaging now." Zatalai looked and saw one apparent engagement, where flights of banshees and seraphs were dropping down from the Ring of Mighty Abundance to engage a human craft in a lower orbit. He pointed at the fight. "What is happening there?"
"Nothing to worry about," Survey said. "Another diversion!"
"It was a surface raid," Cavarossi said, seeming to sense Zatalai's alarm. "A handful of stealth craft made comet-strike entries over the poles. Two of them survived long enough to attack skylifts."
"And?"
"And it was a feint," Survey insisted. "They destroyed some equipment and killed some drudges."
"But the skylifts were unaffected."
"Is that not what I just said?" Survey asked.
Cavarossi shot Survey a look that suggested he wanted to tie the San Shayum's long neck into a knot, then turned back to Zatalai. "What troubles you, Blade Master?"
"That I was not told of this sooner."
Zatalai turned and started toward the exit.
"I hope there is still time."
"Time for what?"
Cavarossi fell in at his side. "Three of their attack craft have been turned away or destroyed already, and the last will not make it out of orbit."
"It doesn't matter," Zatalai said. "Their ploy succeeded."
Cavarossi grabbed Zatalai by the shoulder, a liberty he survived only because of the honor he had shown earlier, when he had assumed sole responsibility for his imaginary mistake.
"Explain yourself, Blade Master."
"As you wish, but listen well. I have no time to repeat myself."
Cavarossi clacked his mandibles for Zatalai to continue.
"The humans were not trying to destroy the skylifts," he said. "They wanted to use them."
Cavarossi's nostrils flared so wide they looked like a second set of eyes.
"What?"
"Confirm it with the planetary lord if you wish."
Zatalai pulled free of the Fleetmaster's grasp and headed for the exit again.
"But I must go. The humans are already in the skylifts."
"Then there is no problem," Survey said. "Simply reverse the lifts."
"And return them to the surface of a holy world? To defile it further?"
Cavarossi was clearly aghast.
Zoist was the sacred abode of the 10 cities of edification, which had once been a home to the Forerunners themselves. The entire planet was viewed as holy to the Covenant because so much of the knowledge that empowered its starship and weapons technology had been recovered from the ancient guild halls dominating the hallowed cities, and there were still thousands of artisans and engineers hard at work trying to understand the wonders that the Forerunners had left for them to discover. Wonders that no infidel could ever be permitted to see.
"I cannot believe a minor minister would utter such blasphemy."
"I am only suggesting a way to undo your incompetence," Survey replied. "The Hierarchs will punish you less for defilement than for losing an entire fleet station."
"It would be more than defilement," Zatalai said. "If we reverse the skylifts now, the Spartans will escape across Zoist and bathe in the forbidden light of the Forerunner's divine knowledge, and then who will be to blame?"
"Not I."
Cavarossi motioned Zatalai toward the exit.
"Go, and kill them while you still can."
Chapter 27. 16:15 hours. April 15th, 2526. Military calendar. Upper Terminus. Unidentified Covenant Space Elevator. Geostationary Orbit. Planet Naraka. Agni System. Through the wall of the anti-gravity beam, John 117 could see Naraka's horizon falling swiftly away. The distant stars were shifting parallax so fast they seemed to be sinking behind the planet, and above him the elevator terminus was finally coming into view. A tiny yellow oval at the moment. But John was beginning to think it had been a mistake to assume that a Covenant lift beam would be as fast as a human space elevator. He had told Small Bear to set a 40-minute delay on the Fury she had left at the bottom, and the countdown on his HUD had just dropped to 5 minutes.
Normally that wouldn't worry him, since 3rd Platoon was tens of thousands of kilometers above Ground Zero. Normally, that would be more than a safe distance. But John had no idea how the electromagnetic pulse of a 1 megaton thermonuclear explosion might affect an alien anti-gravity beam, or how much of the shockwave would be funneled straight up the narrow column toward the platoon. The countdown on John's HUD reached 4 minutes 45 seconds. The terminus above continued to swell larger, and a tiny black dot appeared in the center. The dot was probably the portal where the elevator entered the installation. He kept his eyes fixed on it until the count on his HUD reached 4 minutes 30 seconds. It was doubling in size every 5 seconds. The elevator beam was about 20 meters across. His onboard computer did the calculations, and an ETA of 60 seconds appeared on John's HUD. That gave them a safety margin of 3.5 minutes between portal arrival and the detonation of the Fury left with Chavez. Plenty of time. John was relieved. Then they began to decelerate. The onboard computer did another set of calculations, and a new ETA appeared on his HUD. 3 minutes 5 seconds. Then it helpfully posted the new safety margin in blinking yellow. 22 seconds. Over the platoon channel, John said, ETA 3 minutes. Once we enter the support ring, we're going to have to move fast and keep moving fast. Ready your device fuses now. 3-minute delay and 60-minute auto. The 3-minute delay was stingy by design. It did not give an assault team much time to clear an area after activating the fuse, but they would be operating in a heavily populated environment, and a longer delay would give the enemy too much time to find the explosive device, whether a nuke or an octa, and toss it out an airlock. The 60-minute automatic was simply a safety protocol to keep the device from falling into enemy hands if it was lost, or the trooper carrying it was killed. If the timer was not disengaged with an override code, the weapon would detonate automatically in an hour. John and the other Spartans entered the delays on the 3 devices they were carrying, the octas on their hips and the Havocs mag-clamped on their lower backs, while the Black Daggers worked in pairs to program the octas carried above their thruster packs. By the time everyone reported ready, the ETA had fallen to 50 seconds, and the entry portal overhead had grown so large it filled the sky. A sky packed with spinning alien bodies and slowly tumbling crates.
Bad sign, Small Bear said. There's nobody pulling the cargo out of the elevator.
We can't wait, John said. Fred, go left. Kelly, go right. Lieutenant, they could use some support.
Small Bear assigned a fire team to follow each Spartan. Then Fred and Kelly hit their thrusters and led their support teams up the beam ahead of the rest of the platoon. Their progress could hardly be called swift, since they were working against the decelerating force of the beam itself. But they were able to move ahead of the rest of the platoon, then gather in a loose formation beneath the lid of slowly swirling crates and corpses. Rather than alert the enemy to their presence by poking their heads out to look for trouble, Fred and Kelly simply grabbed the rim of the portal and pulled themselves up. They opened fire with rockets and bullets as soon as they were clear, then vanished into the terminus, their support teams rising out of the elevator beam into a torrent of return fire. 3 troopers fell back into the beam on Fred's side and 2 on Linda's, missing limbs or heads, their assault armor puckered in front and blown out in back by large explosive rounds.
Killzone, Fred reported. 2 more troopers tumbled into the portal. Wedge angle crossfire, at least 200 hostiles at 20 meters, centered 3 o'clock off my exit bearing.
Breakout options? John asked.
Transit tube 12 o'clock.
The ETA on John's HUD showed 32 seconds. The Fury left with Chavez would detonate 22 seconds after that. What that might mean for anyone still inside the anti-gravity beam was the last thing he wanted to find out. He pictured the situation Fred had described inside the terminus, and realized almost instantly what he had to do.
Lieutenant, he said, I need to break out Blue Team to run bombs through that transit tube. Can you give us a rolling screen?
Small Bear hesitated, a sure sign she understood what John was asking of her, then finally answered in a thin voice,
Sure, Chief. We can do that.
She began to issue the necessary orders. John swapped his M90 for the MA-5B and laid his finger on the trigger guard of the underslung grenade launcher, then switched to team comm.
Kelly, when we come out of here, I was listening, John.
She paused, then added, I wish there was another way.
Me too. Let me know if you have one.
I don't.
The ETA on John's HUD read 10 seconds. He and Glinda used their thrusters to slip into position with Small Bear and her platoon. Sierra Force had not deployed any comm relay drones for fear of betraying its presence, but he knew from Lieutenant Gite's parting message that the two prowlers carrying Gold Team and 1st and 2nd Platoons Delta had been forced to abort their insertion run. Even more frustrating, there was no way to check with Kurt 051 and see whether Green Team had managed to recover and infiltrate the orbital fleet support ring. With luck, they'd also made it this far, and there would be 4 more Spartans and another 25 space assault troopers helping Blue Team and 3rd Platoon destroy orbital facilities.
But John knew better than to count on it. There was just as good a chance that 3rd Platoon would be the only team to reach orbit at all, and the Covenant would not be shaken by a raid that knocked out just 1 or 2 installations. To be sure of taking down the entire orbital ring, Blue Team needed to destroy all 10 facilities themselves.
John and Linda reached the top of the lift beam with 3rd Platoon, then pushed their weapons up through the blanket of drifting bodies and crates. Small Bear's voice came over the platoon channel.
Now!
They blind-fired a volley of grenades and rockets in the general direction of the enemy and hit their thrusters, rising out of the portal into a firestorm. They were in a huge, ovoid chamber stacked with crates, ingots, and bodies, all good cover for the enemy. And these guys were soldiers.
John felt half a dozen spikes and needles glance off his armor and saw an ODST ahead of him separate into 3 parts. He fired a grenade toward a line of forms wearing the same red-black armor he had seen at Sayoba. Then Small Bear yelled, "Go, go, go!" And 3rd Platoon, what remained of it, raced forward, pouring bullets and grenades and rocket fire into a line of Covenant crouched behind a makeshift breastwork of metal ingots.
John fired another grenade over the troopers' heads and started across the deck behind them, angling toward the mouth of the transit tube more than 100 meters away. A trio of brutes clambered over a stack of the metal ingots and tried to cut him off, but Fred stepped out from behind a stack of crates and hit them with a pair of spanker rockets. John took out the 3rd brute with a grenade, and he had a clear path all the way to the tube. He stopped halfway there, dropping to his butt behind a pile of toppled crates to reload his grenade launcher. The safety margin blinking on his HUD had changed to red. 10 seconds until the Fury detonated at the bottom of the space elevator. John finished the reload, spun to a knee, and stuck his head up to see an approaching elite literally step through an ODST he had just split down the center with an energy sword. John opened up with his assault rifle. It took half a magazine to knock down the energy shield, but finally the alien's torso armor puckered and began to seep blood. The alien kept coming and did not go down until John sprayed another 12 rounds into his knees. Linda and Kelly sprinted past and took positions inside the mouth of the transit tube. 3rd Platoon's rolling screen had fallen to a handful of troopers, and the aliens were pouring out of cover to mount a charge. 5 seconds.
Disengage! John called over the platoon channel.
He retreated toward the tube at a run, emptying his grenade launcher as he went. A handful of 3rd Platoon survivors sprinted past, so heavily laden with spare spanker barrels that they were barely keeping ahead of the jackals and elites that followed close on their heels. Fred and Kelly slowed the aliens with a couple of long MA-5B bursts that left the 2nd rank tripping over the bodies of the 1st. Then Linda went to work with her M99, drilling brute after brute between the eyes and sending them tumbling into those behind.
0. And out of time. Nothing happened, except that Lieutenant Smallbear appeared 10 meters away, a short figure in assault armor vaulting over a stack of ingots. A sword-wielding elite followed close behind. John raised his assault rifle to cover her, then felt a hand grab his fission reactor.
"Get in here," Kelly said.
She jerked John into the transit tube, and the elite chasing Smallbear went flying backward as an M99 round blew his torso open. The lieutenant glanced back, then stumbled over the body of a dead jackal.
and was blown flat as the shockwave from the Fury detonation finally arrived, much reduced in power after climbing tens of thousands of kilometers up the elevator column, but still powerful enough to send bodies flying in every direction, knocking the remaining aliens off their feet and hurling them into the stacks of the breastwork. Miraculously, Small Bear wasn't hit by anything. She looked up, her astonishment at her survival obvious in the way she held her helmet cocked to one side. John waved her forward, but as she rose, the decompression hit, sucking everything down through the empty elevator portal. Small Bear extended an arm, reaching for help, then went sliding back toward the center of the terminus. John tried to help, but even a Spartan's arm was not that long. The transit tube's emergency hatch irised shut, almost closing on John's hand before he could pull it back. His helmet speakers filled with the startled cries and shouts of the wounded and the dying. Then Small Bear's voice sounded above the rest, her command status auto-dampening everything else on the channel. "Carry on, Chief. Make it count." John banged his fist against the hatch so hard that he dented it, then took a breath and stepped back. An order was an order, and Small Bear had been clear about what she expected. John turned around to find the rest of Blue Team and 6 Third Platoon survivors watching him expectantly. Fred sat in the driver's compartment of a half-loaded cargo sled that looked large enough to haul an entire platoon, along with a couple of pieces of field artillery. The sleds were simple vehicles, little more than an egg-shaped driver's compartment attached to the front of a cargo bed, long enough to hold 2 Spartans lying end to end. Several more sleds were parked along the sides of the transit tube, most in various stages of being loaded with a variety of materials. "You heard the lady," he said. "Let's make this count." He received a chorus of enthusiastic replies and helmet bobs, but they still needed a plan. John looked to Fred. "You figure out how to drive that thing?"
"Sort of," Fred said. "The controls aren't too different from the Banshees, at least in how you work them."
"Close enough," John said. He turned to the surviving assault troopers and motioned them onto the sled. "If we want to stay ahead of the Covenant and knock out enough installations to take this ring down, we need to move fast. Spartan 104 will show you how to operate this thing. Once you're good, he'll turn it over to you and switch vehicles. Clear?" The troopers dipped their helmets in quick nods, and a husky male voice said, "So far?" "The rest is easy." John outlined a simple plan, then finished, "When you're out of Octus, exfiltrate the best way you can and call for a ride." The troopers piled their spare spanker barrels onto the sled behind Fred, then moved forward to learn how the vehicle was operated. John slipped into the driver's compartment of a second vehicle, which was loaded about 3/4 full with ingots of some kind of silvery blue metal. Kelly and Linda mounted a third vehicle, also loaded with the metal ingots. As Fred had indicated, the controls were similar to a Banshee's, but much simpler. There was basically a pair of handle grips to control speed and vector, and no weapon triggers. John placed his weapons in the driver's compartment beside him, then straddled the driver's bench and placed both hands on the grips. The vehicle immediately whirred to life, its anti-gravity pads lifting it about a half meter off the floor. He moved the grips forward, and the sled began to accelerate. Kelly and Linda came up beside him, Kelly driving and Linda kneeling in the cargo bed, using a stack of ingots as a firing rest for her M99. Fred brought up the rear, his voice echoing in John's helmet as he instructed the Black Daggers in driving the alien vehicle. The transit tube was basically a flattened oval about 5 meters high and 3 times that in width, with one roadbed running along the floor of the tube and another along the ceiling. Presumably, the aliens used artificial gravity to keep the sled secured to the appropriate surface, with the floor designated for outbound traffic and the ceiling for empty inbound traffic. Along the walls ran a 2-meter viewing band, through which John could see the crisscrossing beams of the transit tube's trussing armature. Through the armature gaps on the left side, he saw Naraka's cloud-mottled face. If he craned his neck far enough, he could see distant sections of the fleet support ring. To his delight, the ring had a visible gap about 1/4 of its circumference behind him, and he did not see the blue spoke of a space elevator running down to the planet's surface beneath the gap. At least part of Green Team had made it that far, and they had destroyed at least 1 orbital facility. but it was going to take more than a small gap like that to destabilize the entire ring. Blue Team still had a lot of work to do. Through the right-hand band, John could see the Covenant fleet departing its shielding orbit, repositioning itself to... What? Fire plasma cannons against its own support installations? The aliens would no doubt launch swarms of starfighters, but even they would not be of much use against a force that had already infiltrated their facilities. It was an infantry fight now, and in that arena, the Spartans held the advantage. John felt the sled wobble as Fred jumped aboard and dumped an armload of spanker barrels into the cargo bed. A few minutes later, the dark oval of a closed hatch appeared at the end of the transit tube ahead. Fred grabbed his spanker and kneeled in the front of the cargo bed, and the barrier vanished in an orange ball of flame and smoke. John aimed the sled at the center of the ball, and ducking down in the compartment to make himself as small a target as possible, drove straight into the flames. The sled bounced a couple of times as it struck the edges of the jagged hull, and then they were shooting across the deck of one of the orbiting fleet support facilities that were linked by the transit tube. This one looked like some kind of huge smelter. A few needles and plasma bolts rained down from the girders overhead, but the barrage was so light and poorly aimed that it had to be coming from an amateur security team rather than a military unit. John kept the control grips pushed forward and barely bothered dodging, while Fred created confusion and conserved ammunition by flinging ingots at anything they passed. At the speed they were traveling, the heavy ingots landed with the force of a rocket strike, taking out cargo sleds, cranes, even a crucible filled with molten metal. So far, John's strategy of moving fast was working well. The enemy was obviously scrambling, unable to move effective forces into place quickly enough to defend themselves. A textbook raiding technique. Except for losing most of 3rd Platoon. Casualties that high were never textbook. The cargo sleds reached the far side of the smelter and entered the transit tube. Linda and Kelly pulled up beside Fred and John to maximize firepower if they ran into trouble ahead. Having paused to find a good place to hide their octa, the Black Daggers had fallen a couple of minutes behind by the time they entered the transit tube, reporting one trooper injured. John started a new 2.5-minute countdown. The team would have to breach the transit tube before the octa detonated in the smelter, or risk being taken out by their own shockwave. They reached the next installation at just over 2 minutes. Again, the hatch was closed, and again Fred hit it with a spanker rocket. This time, most of the fireball blew back into the transit tube, and John glimpsed something dark looming on the other side of the destroyed hatch. "Second rocket!" he began to decelerate. "Barricade!" Fred fired again, and a gaping hole appeared in the dark mass, but not a hole large enough to drive the cargo sled through. John stopped the vehicle short and adjacent to the door, then grabbed his weapons and fired a grenade one-handed through the hole. "Kelly!" Kelly was already charging through the hole, firing as she moved. Fred followed close behind, the spanker clamped to his back and 4 extra barrels tucked under his arm. In his other hand, he carried his assault rifle. He let off a burst as he stepped through the hole, and an instant later, the firefight had ended. "Clear," Kelly reported. Linda stepped through, heavily burdened with her M99, an MA5B, and an extra case of barrels for Fred's spanker. The Black Daggers arrived just as the countdown on John's HUD reached zero. He wasn't sure how much time actually remained until the octa in the last installation detonated, but it had to be less than 30 seconds. As the assault troopers piled out of their sled, he pointed at the wall of the transit tube. "Hit that with a rocket," John said. "We need a vacuum cushion between us and the detonation." The troopers ignored him and carried their wounded companion through the breached hatch. "Already taken care of." It was a husky-voiced trooper bringing up the rear of the line who said this. "You don't have to be a Spartan to know what happens when you set off an octa in a confined space." He disappeared through the breach after his companions, then stuck his head back through. "Better come along, Chief. There's going to be a hell of a wind in about 10 seconds. Feeling a bit foolish for thinking someone of a Black Dagger's training and experience would need reminding about shockwave hazards, John stepped through the hole and added one to the count of facilities that he could be certain Sierra Force had destroyed. The aliens had toppled one of their cargo sleds in front of the hatch in an effort to defend their installation, and John helped his fellow Spartans turn the vehicle around so that its rounded nose was pushed into the hatch breach. When a charge ruptured the transit tube a couple of seconds later, the decompression sucked the sled's nose deeper into the hole, holding the pressure loss inside the installation to a whistling breeze. By the time they'd finished, a trio of Black Daggers had returned with a pair of replacement cargo sleds and a fresh casualty. Leaving the Daggers to plant their next octa, John and Blue Team climbed into the first sled and took off across what appeared to be a small arms factory. They exchanged fire with a security detail that was taking cover behind the intermittent bulkheads that separated the transit line from the work floor, simultaneously tossing crates off the sled to keep everyone else's heads down, and quickly reached the transit tube portal on the far side. The Black Daggers lagged behind in their sled, engaging in a more protracted firefight as they looked for a place to secure their octa. John didn't see where that was, because by then, he and the rest of the Spartans were in the transit tube and speeding away again. They didn't have time to stop. If what was left of Sierra Force wasn't able to destroy at least 8 more facilities, their chances of bringing down the orbital ring fell off sharply. If they managed to destroy a total of 9 installations instead of 10, Dr. Halsey's estimates gave them only a 71% chance of destabilizing the ring. If they managed to destroy only a total of 7 facilities, their chances of success fell to just 49%. John hadn't even bothered to memorize the odds below that. He hadn't brought Sierra Force all this way to take long shots. He was going to find a way. The trip through the next few installations went much the same, with the Covenant security teams trying new tricks to slow the Spartan advance, and the Spartans finding countermeasures to circumvent them. The Black Daggers ran out of luck in the 6th facility, when the husky-voiced trooper, John hated that there had been no time to ask the man's name, spoke over the platoon channel.
"Afraid we can't keep carrying your water, Blue Team."
His voice was pained and gurgling.
"We'll be going out with our octa this time."
"Acknowledged," John said. "You did the 21st proud."
"Course we did,"
the trooper said.
"Just make sure you finish."
The transmission ended in sharp crackle, and John instructed his onboard computer to log the time and conversation so he could recommend the man and his companions for accommodation, assuming he made it back himself. As Blue Team approached the next installation, John glimpsed a set of efflux tails through the transit tube's lower view band and stopped the vehicle to investigate. What he saw was both elating and dismaying. About a quarter of the orbital fleet support ring was now in ruins, with most of the missing sections directly behind Blue Team, and farther around the circle, a much smaller gap where Green Team had taken out what appeared to be about 3 facilities. Counting the 6 installations that Blue Team had destroyed, that made 9, and the orbital ring was already beginning to show signs of destabilization. There were long pieces of transit tube falling out of orbit, and entire facilities plunging into Naraka's atmosphere, bright trails of fire behind them. But the orbits below the section Green Team had destroyed were also filled with Covenant fighters. Many were flitting madly about, firing on tiny specks and unseen targets that might well be Green Team Spartans or their Black Dagger companions. A few craft seemed to be pursuing more deliberate strategies, traveling to specific points along the ring to cut off the advance of potential infiltrators. And a few kilometers below that, a flight of 10 Banshees was passing beneath the viewport where John stood, heading for a point that looked to be a couple of installations ahead of the Spartans' current location. John dropped to his knees and craned his neck around, trying to see the Banshees' destination, and caught a glimpse of a vessel under construction, with a bow so huge that at first he thought he was seeing things. Fred's voice came over TeamCom, the only channel they were using now that everyone in 3rd Platoon was gone. "John," he said, "now's kind of a bad time for a nap." "Very funny," John said. "Come here, wise guy. Give this a look." Fred came over and kneeled in front of John, then began to crane his neck around.
"Okay, what am I..."
He let the sentence trail off and whistled.
"Wow. What are they building there?"
"Who cares?" John said. "Either way, we're going to blow it up." Linda and Kelly came over and sneaked a look at the vessel. "I like it," Kelly said. "Going out in style."
"Or not." John pointed to the Banshee fighters crossing below. "There's our ride out of here."
Linda studied the Banshee flight for a moment, then craned her neck to look at the huge ship again. "I see only one problem," she said. "That vessel must be more than 20 kilometers long and hundreds of decks high. Even if the Banshees intend to set down there, we could spend days looking for them."
"We'll think of something," John said. "But if I were to guess, whoever is in those Banshees is coming to us."
John led the way back to the cargo sled, and they resumed their advance. The next facility turned out to be a dormitory, so after blasting their way in, they had to shoot their way across 1,000 meters of metal-floored lobby, laying heavy suppression fire on at least 50 jackals. The aliens were so poorly trained that their idea of blocking in advance was to hide behind the furniture on both sides of the kill zone and lay blind plasma fire in an inadvertent crossfire. They hit each other more than they did the Spartans or their vehicles, and they weren't wearing armor. By the time Blue Team emerged on the other side, Fred was down to 2 Spanker missiles. John had just 3 grenades. Kelly had 2, and nobody had more than a single magazine for their assault rifles. But everybody still had an M6 sidearm with a full clip. John still had 12 shotgun rounds in his M90, and Linda had 52 for her M99. So they were well supplied for both long-distance combat and close assault. It was just the in-between ranges, where most firefights actually occurred, that would be a problem. "Not over yet," John thought. "We can do this." As they rode toward their next firefight, Blue Team spent their time brainstorming plans, and by the time the transit tube began to branch into different forks and levels, John thought they had something workable. They stopped and reset the fuses on their remaining ordnance, 2 octas and 4 havocs, to 2-minute delays, then went to the viewing band and took another look at their final objective, a massive tangle of girders and airtight passageways that probably masked more than all of their other targets combined. Annihilating it would unbalance a whole section of the orbital ring, and the wreckage that wasn't vaporized in the blast would be hurled away with immense force, dragging along everything to which it was attached. The entire structure would slide out of orbit and plunge flaming into Naraka's cloudy atmosphere, virtually guaranteeing a severely hemorrhaged Covenant supply chain. A bloody nose, John hoped the aliens would not soon forget. Now that they were almost directly above the space docks, they also had a much clearer view of the vessel itself. Most of the immense ship they'd spied earlier was hidden between the 2 huge fabrication barns that hung down to either side of its patchwork hull. But the oval bow had already been completely covered. To John, it resembled the head of one of those huge, grinning whales whose pictures he had seen during the Earth module of his human history classes. The Banshee flight that he had seen before had already arrived and disappeared into one of the fabrication barns, but John could see a lot of rushing silhouettes in the mouth of a hangar about 1/4 of the way down the starboard barn. Given the timing and circumstances, he thought it safe to assume he was looking at the Banshee flight's location. He pointed to the hangar. "Set that as your waypoint," he said. "Then check the pressure integrity and rebreather status of your Mjolnir." "I'm going to need some patching," Fred said. "Who isn't?" Kelly asked, reaching for a cargo patch. "I just hope we have enough." "We do." Linda drew 2 handfuls of patches from her thigh pouch. "I brought extra." Some of the patches had Black Dagger insignias on the split peel, but John didn't ask. Battlefield scavenging was a necessity for behind-the-lines operators. A few minutes later, they backed to the far side of the transit tube. Then Linda opened fire on the viewing band with her M99. The first round barely dimpled the sturdy material, and the second merely created a cloudy disk. But they had a lot more high-impact sniper rounds than they did Spanker missiles, so John had her keep trying. The 5th round created a web of outward radiating stress cracks. 5 more shots around the perimeter of the web produced more cracks, and a high-pitched whistling as the transit tube began to depressurize. John motioned Fred forward. "Give it a kick." Fred sprang into a 2-booted flying sidekick that shattered the viewing pane and sucked him out into space. "Like that?" he calmed. No one answered. They were too busy trying to avoid being knocked into a tumble as they were pulled through the breach together. Once they were outside and began to drift apart, it grew easier to bring themselves under control. They quickly formed into a proper fire team, with John and Kelly 30 meters from each other in front, and Fred and Linda about 20 meters behind them. They activated their thruster packs and began to descend toward a small oval of light set amid a vast wall of oval lights. In his mind, John heard Avery Johnson warning him not to lead from the front. Trouble was, when units got this small, there was no place left but the front. Besides, Chavez and Small Bear and the rest of 3rd Platoon and a lot of other courageous Sierra Force soldiers had sacrificed their lives well. Much of the alien fleet support ring was starting to fall out of orbit in ruins. 2 space elevators had been destroyed, and at least 1 Covenant city on Naraka's surface was now a radioactive ruin. The mission had already succeeded. Whatever happened next, the Covenant was going to know that humans fought back. The hangar mouth yawned wider as the team drew nearer. John began to see shadows along the threshold. It was hard to tell their species, but most seemed to be dragging hoses and pulling lev carts, so they were probably just maintenance hands, and not much of a threat in their own right. If John's assumption was correct, that the Banshee pilots were a Covenant Special Forces unit assigned to hunt down infiltrators, then the aliens' most capable fighters would be 20 decks above, rushing to intercept Blue Team before they breached the transit tube hatches. Assuming that everything went according to plan, those unknown hunters would die having never seen a Spartan when one of Blue Team's Havocs detonated 20 decks below. And that was just fine with John. He didn't feel any need to look them in the eye or acknowledge their courage. All that mattered to him was stopping them, and he didn't much care how he did it. Blue Team dropped even with the hangar mouth, and John confirmed that his assumption about the source of the shadows had been correct. In the silvery worklight, he could see a 3 Jackal crew tending each of the Banshees, with a couple of grunts puttering nearby in an open cockpit. He saw no sign of a security team, though there were plenty of dark corners where a brute or two might be lurking. And in the back of the large chamber stood a pair of luminous blue columns that he assumed to be alien lift tubes. "Looks like we're good to go," John said of her team comm. "Everybody ready?" A trio of status lights winked green inside his helmet. Since he had only 28 rounds remaining in his MA-5B magazine, he switched his fire selector to single and hit his thrusters. John's HUD flickered and dimmed slightly as he passed through the energy barrier at the hangar entrance. Then his boots thudded to the deck as the artificial gravity kicked in. He immediately opened fire, concentrating on the left side of the hangar and putting a single round into every alien he saw. The Jackals went down either limp or convulsing, but always with surprise in their eyes. The grunts either collapsed or exploded as their methane packs detonated. A couple of breaths later, M99 rounds started to drop John's targets before he could, and Fred's voice sounded over TeamCom. "We're in. Step 2. John and Kelly stopped firing long enough to move over to the nearest Banshees and reach inside, bringing the impulse drives online and activating the instrument consoles. They checked to make sure the controls responded to their touch, then repeated the sequence on the next 2. Assured that at least 4 of the craft were operable, John said, "Good to go. Step 3. He and Kelly fired a few rounds to keep the enemy confused and their heads down, then dropped behind cover and removed the last of the Havocs from their mag mounts. They opened the control covers, then tucked the bombs under their arms. John looked over to see if Kelly was ready, and received a green status wink in return. "Go!" Each holding a Havoc in one hand and an assault rifle in the other, they jumped up and raced toward the lift beams in the back of the hangar. So far, the maintenance crews were either hiding or dying, and nobody opened fire. The assault was going even easier than planned. So far. 20 paces from the lifts, John said, "Initiate." "Affirmative," Kelly replied. "Initializing." Zatulai stepped out of the gravity lift to find 50 Kigyar standing beside the overturned cargo sleds they used to haul scrap away from the Hammer of Faith, the supercarrier being built in the huge construction crash. Their long muzzles were hanging agape, and they were staring after Castor and Orsoon as the two Jirohanai pushed their way up the traffic-choked passageway, bellowing at the drivers to clear the way and flipping their sleds aside when it proved impossible to comply. The passageway curved out of sight before Zatalai could see what was blocking traffic, but he had no doubt that it involved the Spartans. A trio of second blades in black Bloodstar armor stepped out of the gravity lift and turned to follow the two Jirohanai. "Wait," Zatalai ordered. When the trio obeyed, he switched from the Bloodstar battlenet to his helmet's external speaker, then turned to the nearest sled driver. "Does this passageway not lead to the ring road?"